Welcome to our podcast for Raising Arizona Kids Magazine. I'm Vicki Belind. Natalia Conti passed out blankets because she knew firsthand that cancer treatments can make you cold. She'd walk the halls of the oncology floor to reassure other patients fighting pediatric cancer, just as she was. The Conti family of Gilbert lost Natalia at age 14 to the disease in January 2011. So they formed the Purple Society, a foundation that supports families around the world in fighting pediatric cancer. Anthony Conti talks about empowering parents, searching for treatment options, and the legacy his daughter left behind.
You know, traditionally you rely on the hospital to provide all the services that you need. But unfortunately, in the cancer world, it's not utopia. They just don't have the resources or the budgets to provide the research that's needed for individual types of cancer and especially childhood cancer. You know, one of the big things that we look at is over the past 50 years, there's only been two new treatments that have gotten through the FDA, which is really, you think about that, that's just totally ridiculous. For children, we're losing so many children every year. I believe I just saw a statistic the other day that it's a classroom full, 26 kids a day, a classroom full of kids are dying every single day in America. You know, that's crazy. So we should be putting much more of our resources towards there. The hospitals aren't able to do it. You know, I don't know if they're not able to do it or they don't want to do it or it's just not profitable. So that's where our foundation comes in. That's where we try and change things. We provide those resources. We provide a lot of the education and a lot of the research for the clinical trials.
One of the things that comes to mind, though, is maybe some would say that some of these clinical trials, scientists or researchers are very hesitant to use them on children.
Yeah, you know, that's something that, again, being not only a researcher, but also living through the whole system with my daughter, Natalia, you know, when you look at the actual policy that the United States government has on children, and actually in the policy itself, it's written that they are part of a vulnerable population if you're under the age of 18. And as a parent, you say, yes, I agree with that, that they are vulnerable, they need to be protected. But when your child is faced with a decision of, look, we know what happens when we don't give them treatment, they're going to die. And when we do give them treatment, are we going to hurt them? Well, I mean, the common sense has been taken out of the factor. So once a child is diagnosed with cancer, they should be removed from that vulnerable population policy and say, here's children that we know are in desperate need of help. We need to try everything that's in our tool belt to help these children and to try and save them. So that's part of the policy stuff that needs to get changed. And we're working a lot with the Senate and Congress. I've spoken to Congress twice, and we've been blessed to be able to have a voice in Congress. And hopefully with all of our members and all the purple people that we deal with, hopefully we'll be able to make a change.
So what kind of the resources are most important for a family to access after a kiddo has been diagnosed, and how do you help?
The number one thing is education. Your first decision, and I mean, I didn't know this, so it's a very difficult thing. I think, you know, Not in My Backyard kind of really plays a big role in this, where people never think about childhood cancer. No one wants to think about it. I never did. You know, I never wanted to think about it. But your first decision on treatment really dictates the entire life cycle of the treatment for the child. So that first decision that you make out of the box is unbelievably important. I think at the core, you need to be educated. Parents need to understand that when they get that diagnosis, that there are options, that they need to understand what those options are, and they need to be able to look at multiple hospitals, multiple cancer centers in order to get the best treatment. It's like anything else in the world. You know, there's hospitals that are great, and then there's hospitals that are not so great. And just because your child was diagnosed in a not so great hospital doesn't mean that that's where they have to be treated at. And a lot of times with clinical trials, you know, it's not available at every hospital. So you really do need to know that. So we provide that service. We actually have the only clinical trials map that's out there. We actually have the patent trademark on this clinical trial map that most of the hospitals in the U.S. use. to find clinical trials. It's very simple. We make it available on our website for free for everyone, so you could actually sit with your medical team and find clinical trials for your child and say, well, hey, what about this one, doc? Hey, is she available for, you know, she eligible for this? Is he eligible for that? So the education part of it is really a big thing. I think that's probably the most important. The second piece would be advocacy. A lot of people fold, and rightfully so. I mean, when you're told your child has cancer, your world comes crumbling down. You really realize that your life is you know, a deck of cards that's just ready to fold. And you know, so they need advocacy. They need people that have been there. They need people that could stand up and say, listen, put the brakes on a second. We realize this is important. We realize that you guys need to make a move. The medical world needs to make a move on this, but we need to really step back. Let's regain our composure and let's figure out what needs to be done, which is hard to do. And I can tell you from experience, it's very hard to do. So we try to provide that with our volunteers, with our members, with us personally. I mean, I spend a lot of time at the hospitals here in Phoenix. I also spend a lot of time at hospitals in Philadelphia and Memphis, Tennessee, and trying to deal with families, getting the right treatment. The last piece of it, and by no means is this the least important, but financial. One thing that you find out right away is that no one has enough money to treat their children. You know, we wound up with millions of dollars in bills, and we were at a hospital that we started out at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, which covers all of your bills. You have no bills from them. And we ended up in Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, which is a normal hospital. I mean, it's a phenomenal hospital, but it's a normal hospital where you get billed. And, you know, there was no way we could have paid those bills. So even though my daughter has gone on to heaven, I still get medical bills every single month coming in from, you know, from her treatment. And, you know, we were almost lost our home. We almost lost all everything that we owned. And it happens to everyone. I'm no one special. I mean, every single person that we deal with, every family needs financial help.
Do you ever get used to seeing that bill come in the mail? That's got to be just wrenching.
Yeah, you never get used to it. As a matter of fact, I got a bill for Natalia's dental bill while she was in a coma in Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and you know, I got a bill in the mail for her dental, you know, dental cleaning, and I just look at that and I just don't understand it. It doesn't make any sense to me as a parent or as someone that is now, you know, over my head in the cancer world, and I don't understand that. I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
It's rough.
Yeah, it kills you. It rips your heart out every time you open that mailbox.
Describe the range of emotions that most parents experience when they begin their treatment journey. You sort of alluded to that before. And how does the Purple Society help with that emotional component? Because I gather that you do talk to a lot of parents that are in that first stage.
Yeah, and I think the first phase of a childhood cancer diagnosis is fear. I mean, I actually remember my wife and I standing in the emergency room and getting the diagnosis, and Natalia was fine. I mean, she was so perfect. She was sitting in the other room and, you know, laughing and just being her normal self. And Suzanne and I had gotten this, my wife Suzanne and I had gotten this diagnosis, and I remember the wind being knocked out of me. I mean, I literally felt like I had to take a knee. Like I really just, you know, something you never expect. So the fear just overcomes you. And you really can't think, and you go into kind of like an instinct mode where you just, you know, try and gather your thoughts as best as possible. And that's a big part for us. And it's a difficult thing to be at that point with other families because they, you know, you don't know when someone is getting diagnosed. It's usually in a hospital somewhere. They get the diagnosis and then they go, oh my God, what do I do now? So we usually get to them right after that point, and it's almost 100% word of mouth. Either a nurse or a doctor or another patient will say, hey, listen, you need to reach out to this foundation. And so we usually get to them at the second phase, which is it's a split phase between denial and wanting to fight. Either you get the parents that are in total denial and they just say, you know what, my kid's going to be fine and we're just going to do whatever the doctors told us and let's just move forward and my life is going to continue to be the same. And then you have the opposite people that you meet that just want to just fight and they're riled up and they're sassy and they just want to get in and fight. That's usually where we get to the parents and to the family. And the third one is numb.
you know, after you've either said, my life is going to be the same, I'm going to be able to handle this and go on, or you say, I'm going to make a decision to fight and really and defeat this, you go through a phase of you're just totally numb, and you don't, a lot of people just fold up in their home, they'll just go home and cry. We try and get to them as early as possible, try and help them through those emotions and help them through each of those steps. Really, we believe that you have to be a fighter. You have, and we're here. If you can't do it, we're here to help you fight. We'll sit in that room with your medical team. We'll sit in that room with all the research. We print out packets of information for these families to take to their research team, their medical team. Because if you're not going to fight, I'm sorry to say this, and I don't want to sound negative, but if you're not going to fight for your child, no one is. Your child is one of 100 kids on a floor that are dealing with childhood cancer, and your doctor is spending 15 minutes a day with that child. You have to be there to make sure that things are going correctly and that the right decisions are made. And that's one of the things that Natalia, my daughter, when she started this foundation, when we were at St. Jude, it's one of the things that she saw, that there were rooms with a child by themselves. The mom couldn't, I mean, a single mom, daughter gets cancer, the mom can't leave her job because she'll lose her insurance. So the mom's not there. So here's a little girl sitting in a room in a hospital fighting for her life, and her mom can't even be there. So Natalia wanted to be that shoulder to step in and to say, you know, lay your head right here. We're going to be with you through it. Don't worry about it. You know, and it's really, that's a huge, that's very, I can't express to you the importance of that. And just letting them know that whatever they will need, whether it's the emotional support, whether it's the research portion of it, or whether it's just that knowing that they have a friend that's maybe 6 months ahead of them, maybe a year ahead of them, that's been there and walked in their shoes, that's so important, and it's something you can't buy.
You mentioned that you were sitting in the room when you got the news and that you were in the emergency room. Can you talk briefly about the initial diagnosis, what the diagnosis was? I know it was a long, long road, but at the beginning.
Natalia, my wife brought Natalia to an ophthalmologist to get her eyes checked. She had 20/20 vision. She was doing great. And the doctor said, the ophthalmologist said, let me dilate her eyes, which they always do. And they dilated her eyes and they saw something in the back of her eye. And she called, she was totally flustered, and she called for a MRI stat, and we went down to St. Joe's immediately, Barrows, and had an MRI done that day. And you know, I just told the story the other night, and you know, I distinctly remember Natalia just smiling, going, it's going to be, telling my wife and I, it's going to be all right, don't worry about it, guys. And here's a little girl, 12 years old, going into an MRI machine and being, you know, an adult would have been broken down. Here she is smiling, reassuring us, and, you know, she got her MRI, and we went right around the corner to a little Italian place to have dinner with the family, and during that dinner, we got a phone call. I mean, it wasn't even an hour, you know, from when she had her MRI, and they told us we had to come directly back to the hospital immediately, and so they said they saw a mass in her MRI, in her brain, in her MRI, and, you know, just... like I said, your world crumbles. It's a house of cards that falls. And we had to compose ourselves and go in and get Natalia, Aviana, and Isabella, our three daughters, and say, we have to go back to the hospital. Doctor wants to talk to us. And we went into PCH, into Phoenix Children's, and into the emergency room, because that's where the doctor was at PCH. And the doctor, Natalia was actually sitting there with her sisters, and they took us into a surgery room. And here's actually, this is a great portion of the story. I don't want to be long-winded, but the great portion of the story is it really got me thinking as an advocate. We went in and we talked to this great doctor. You know, he took us aside and sat us down in a surgical room. It was just an open surgical room. We went and sat in there away from Natalia so she couldn't hear what he was saying. And he rolled up this little laptop computer thing and said, here's her MRIs. And her MRIs, literally, the pictures were about an inch and a half big. Hmm. There was about 10 of them, about an inch and a half big on the screen. And I said, how could you see anything on the screen there? I can't see anything. They're so little. And he said, well, St. Joe's and PCH are on different systems, and we don't communicate with each other. So this is the best I could see at this point until I get over to the other hospital to see what they look like. And at that point, I was already broken, and I was like, I can't understand how here's my child's life hanging in the midst, and you guys won't even communicate with each other and send the files to each other. So that really started the ball rolling of me starting to research and understand how the medical field is so entirely broken. And it's not the doctor's fault. It's actually the administrator's fault. And so it goes really deep there. And so anyway, long story short, he told us that you know, he saw a mass in the center of her brain, and she needed immediate brain surgery. And I had looked at my wife, who at that time had sat down because she couldn't stand up anymore. Her legs were like rubber. And I said to him, are you the best brain surgeon there is? And he said, oh, no, I'm not the best, but I'm a great surgeon. And I said, well, then if you're not the best, I don't want you touching my daughter's brain. I said, I have to go and find the best surgeon there is. I mean, it's not like, you know, we're not talking about a stubbed toe here. We're talking about brain surgery. And so I left the room, and we got Natalia, and we didn't know how to tell Natalia. So we came home, and we tried to remain composed on the ride home. And you know, when we did tell her, we told her with everyone in the room, her two sisters, me and my wife, and in their bedroom, and we said, you know, the doctors saw a brain tumor, and she cried. You know, she was scared, and she cried, and her sisters cried, and we all hugged, and we prayed together, and you know, I don't think you understand. I know you don't understand the depth of fear, and I hate to say the why me. But you do. You go from a perfect family, perfect in every way, to, you know, a doctor telling you, which our diagnosis was after her surgery, they told us that she only had 2 months to live. And you say to yourself, how does your world change so drastically in a few days? You can't figure it out. And the doctors don't have any answers. The world doesn't have any answers for you. And you really do. I mean, we were always spiritual, faithful people, always had a relationship with God. But when I tell you it renews your relationship with God, it really renews your relationship with God. And I mean, whatever religion you are, it doesn't, you know, I'm not saying one religion or another. You need that faith and that strength, because this is beyond what we understand. And it's you can't find an answer. So where do you go when you can't find an answer? You know, you need to lean on your faith. You need to lean on, it's not your will.
I wanted to talk more about Natalia right now, what kind of person she was, and why you think that she was that way, that she inspired the people around her to fight, to give a shoulder. Why?
That was just her character. You ever hear people say, oh, my child has an old soul, or they're, you know, Natalia really did. I mean, it was just unbelievable how she touched people. She had a way of touching people. I mean, all of this that has been created through her dream was 100%, it's not me, it's not my wife, it's not her sisters, it's Natalia. I mean, from the beginning, it was her. And yeah, I remember walking out of St. Jude, and she had been stable for a year, and the doctors had told us that she went in for an MRI. She had like a 4-hour MRI, and she came out. We waited for the results. The results came back, and the doctor took us in another room and told us that they saw progression in the tumor, and there was nothing else they could do for her. Suzanne and I, again, our world came crushing down again. You know, all the year of going through, it's going to be okay, it's going to be okay, it's going to be okay. We're fighting. And then all of a sudden it collapses again. And Natalia, we didn't tell her that, but we came walking out of the Chili Center in Memphis. She was in the middle of us, and we were holding each hand, and Natalia was in the middle of us, and she must have felt our energy. She must have felt our fear. And just as we were walking, she goes, Mom, Dad, don't worry. It's going to be okay. God's not done with me yet. You know, and that's coming from a 12-year-old. Telling their mom and dad, it's okay, God's not done with me yet, don't worry about it. You know, like, that was just her. And, you know, she became known in all the hospitals she was in as someone that, I mean, from the nurses and doctors, someone that the other kids went to. And I remember a 17-year-old girl that was diagnosed with the same type of cancer as Natalia. Natalia had an anaplastic astrocytoma right in the center of her brain, in her thalamus. it doesn't get much worse than that. That diagnosis is just beyond what you could imagine. And a 17-year-old girl had come to St. Jude, and Natalia, we were sitting in the cafeteria, and a nurse came up to us and said, "Do you mind if I have this girl just got diagnosed? She just got here today. Do you mind if she talks to Natalia?" Because Natalia used to talk to all the patients. So a nurse came up to us and asked that, and we said, "Definitely, let her come over." And she came over and sat with Natalia, and Natalia talked to her. A little 12-year-old girl talking to a 17-year-old girl saying, "Don't worry, here's what's going to happen. You're going to have radiation. It's no big deal. Bring Taylor Swift's CD with you. It'll put it on, and you could just zone out and be in your room and just dance." And here's a girl that just was through a year and a half of treatment, had no hair, had two brain surgeries, a shunt placed, and this girl has, Natalia was through the ringer, and she still smiled and faced it and looked at it and just went, "It's all right, don't worry, you're going to be okay." So I can't explain why. I have to say my belief is it's God. There is no explanation for it. We even had doctors, which is unheard of in the medical world, come up to us and say, "Natalia made us find God." And that to me is, that floored us, because that was her. That was who she was, and that's what she stood for. She knew that she had a disease that 99% of the time takes your life, and she was still okay with going into a PICU and going walking and talking to kids and saying, "Hey guys, listen, don't be scared of that radiation thing. You know, when you get chemo, don't be scared of that. When you have your port placed, here's what's going to happen." She was like, it actually became just normal for us to be that way. That's who she was. Her character was just to help. That was her character. If she got toys, she went and passed them out. When she started Natalia's blankets, a woman had walked up to her at St. Jude and given her a blanket. And when children go through radiation treatment, they can't adjust their internal temperature. They have a real issue. And even like here, when it's 109 outside, kids are still freezing. Someone had given her a blanket, and she went, "Dad, we need to do this. We should get blankets for everybody." So she called my mother and she said, "Nanny, could you, talk to your friends?" My mom crochets. And she goes, "Could you talk to your friends and start making blankets?" And we were living in Memphis for her treatment. And so my mom went to her friends and began to make these blankets and send boxes of them out to us. And Natalia would go room to room and hand out these blankets. And they started calling Natalia's blankets. And they would go, "Oh, we have another delivery of Natalia's blankets." And so that's kind of how that portion of the foundation started, and it grew and grew and grew. And we've done, in 2011, we did over 3,000 blankets to the hospitals, which is pretty incredible. And it keeps growing. This year we're adding Boston Children's Hospital to the delivery list, so it'll keep growing. And it's just a very small piece of what she wanted to do, just to give a little love to someone that can take a blanket and put it on them and know that someone that cared about them gave it to them. All of her ideas expanded throughout the foundation on what we're trying to accomplish. And it's an unbelievably grassroots. It's not about how much money can my event pull in, or how much money could the foundation stockpile to be able to give grants. It's not about that. I'd rather have you go, "Hey, Anthony, I'd love to go buy a $100 fries card and give it to a family at PCH that is broke now because they spent all their money on cancer treatment and they need to feed their other two kids." That's where the change is. The change is by all of us doing it, not by one foundation being the king of the hill and trying to facilitate everything through dollars and cents. I think it really has to be at a grassroots level. And that was Natalia's dream, to make it that way, because she saw that with us. When we were losing everything, our community here came out of the woodwork to help us. When we were in Memphis, people we didn't even know came out and would bring us dinners. And I can't tell you how important it is when you're sitting there and you know you have $15 left in your bank account, and you go, "Oh my God, I have a family of five to feed. How am I going to feed a family of five tonight? I only have $15. I'm not kidding. I mean, we have $15 left in our bank account." And you have someone that you never met before knock at your door and go, "Hey, listen, I cooked you dinner tonight." That's amazing. And it's such a simple thing to do. And we believe that if people knew, if people understood that just driving me to the airport with my daughter, that's huge. That's giant, because those little things are the things that you shouldn't have to think about. You should worry about keeping your child alive and being there with your child, not how am I paying my water bill this month.
Has your work in helping other families, has that helped even just a bit in your own healing? Because you do see this, you see people that work on to help other people, and that does, it never can replace your daughter, but does it have a little bit of a therapeutic effect on you as a person?
Yes, it definitely does, and I see it in my whole family. I think for us, this is what Natalia left us. This is her legacy. This is what she wanted to do. So for me personally, I feel closer to Natalia when I'm in a cancer unit, when I'm walking through PCH, or I'm walking through Cardin's, or I'm at CHOP in Philadelphia, and I'm walking through those rooms and seeing those kids. I could directly see my daughter in their eyes, and I know that she's there with me doing this, and I just feel closer to her. I mean, people think we're crazy, but I know even I have two other daughters, Aviana and Isabella, and I know when they're in the hospital, I know they feel the same way. My wife, the same way. I can tell you countless times that we're in the hospital and we'll be in a cancer unit, and my wife goes, look, that's Natalia. And I'll see a little girl walk by all in purple. And I've posted it on a blog several times where we go to a hospital and all of a sudden you see someone dressed all in purple, a little girl walk by and big brown eyes. And I look at her and I go, there's my girl. That's her just telling me, hey, Dad, you know, this is what she wanted. And this is why we continue to do this. My days are really split up, and my wife is unbelievably busy doing the Purple Society. Both my girls, actually somebody asked my girls, not yesterday, the day before, they go, so how's your summer going? What are you doing all summer? And they're like, oh, we're Purple Society all summer. We have this event going. We're doing this with the kids. We just delivered cookies down at the hospital. We're doing, you know, we were at Ryan's house yesterday delivering stuff, and that's their world. And, you know, their experience at such a young age is really going to blossom. I say to my wife all the time, we're setting the stage, and that generation of kids are the ones that are going to really push through and push it to the next phase.
And what do you think Natalia would have to say about that, the past year and a half or so since she's passed away, your lives?
I'm going to try and keep my composure as I say this, because it's very difficult to think of her not being here. I think she'd be very proud of where we're at, and I think she'd be really proud to know that her dream has helped hundreds of families. I know personally hundreds of families that we've spoken to in the United States that we've helped. And I know that's her and that's what she wanted. And, you know, we've had thousands. We have 28,000 people that have used the have become members on the website and have used the educational pieces worldwide. And we have over 21 million page views on our website of people around. Sometimes I'll go on at nighttime and I see, we have a little live, it tells you who's on live and on the website. And I see people in Egypt, people in China on the website. And I say to myself, I don't know anybody in Egypt. I don't know anybody in China. How are these people on the site? And I just know it's what she wanted and it's what her dream is. And, you know, 10 years from now, if we can be changing lives, if we could be changing the way that the hospitals actually interact with the families, and if we can do that, that's where we want to be at, and that's what we want to do. And until then, we help families one by one, because that's what she did. She walked into each and every room, and that's what we do. We are right there in the trenches, there to hug you, and there to say, let's look at this, and let's figure it out together. And that's what we'll continue to do, and hopefully throughout the life of this foundation, that's what it will become. It'll never be, as long as I'm involved, my wife's involved, and my kids are involved, we'll never be at that 30,000-foot view where we look down and go, oh, well, here's what's happening. We're always going to be the ones that are going to walk in that room, and every volunteer will be the same way. And my hope is that when they take that step into that room, they think of Natalia.
Listen to more podcasts on our website at RaisingArizonaKids.com. I'm Vicki Belint. Thanks for listening.
Raising Arizona Kids Radio is a Small Change production. All rights reserved. This material may not be broadcast or redistributed without permission.
Mm-hmm.